We're on the record in the Senate Judiciary Committee at 1:43 in the afternoon of Friday, April the 4th. We have a quorum. Senator McGuire is here. Thank you, Senator McGuire, Senator Wilkowski, myself, Senator French. We have two matters before us today. The first is HB 286, which we heard and held during the last committee because we had a amendment pending at that time and decided to fall back, think it over, and come to a group decision. The procedural posture at that time was that an amendment was pending. It was my amendment. At this point, I'm going to withdraw that amendment. And underneath that, and so the amendment being withdrawn, we now have a CS in front of us, backslash C, if we could have a motion to adopt it.
Moved.
Without any objection, hearing and seeing none, the CS is before us. The CS, in essence, incorporates that amendment, but makes it a little bit smoother. And as you can see, the crime of impersonating a public servant in the first degree would be what happens when a person commits the crime of impersonating a public servant in the first degree if the person violates the underlying statute by pretending to be a peace officer and purports to exercise the authority of a peace officer in relation to another person. The debate we were having in the last committee hearing was whether we should fix the underlying statute, which merely requires a person to do any act in that capacity. And my view is that that statute's been on the books. It has been an offense that could be used. It hasn't been used much, but the focus of the bill sponsor was to get impersonating a peace officer as a felony, given the huge authority that those individuals have when they're out on the street, out on the road, and perhaps dressed up in a uniform, or perhaps just using a badge. But in any event, that's the sum and substance of the CS. Let me turn to the committee members for discussion. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At a minimum, what if we said on line 11, pretends to be a public servant and purports to exercise the authority of a public servant? I don't know. I guess we can leave it. Did Luckup look at it at all?
He drafted the CS.
Okay, and he didn't see any problem with does any act?
I have received no information from him that he thought the underlying statute needed to be fixed.
Where does it go next?
This is the last committee of referral.
I need some explaining on what the difference is between 827A, where it says pretending to be a peace officer and purports to exercise the authority of a peace officer in relation to another person, and section 2, where pretends to be a public servant. Okay, I see. So the difference is one's peace officer, one's public servant.
All public servants are peace officers.
Right.
No, other way around. All peace officers, thank you, are public servants. The logicians in the crowd all leapt up as a whole. All peace officers are public servants. So a peace officer could in fact violate the B MISTO by doing any act in that capacity.
Yeah.
Maybe by carrying a badge, but not by exercising the authority. You probably shouldn't carry a police badge in your wallet, right? If you're not a police officer.
Well, but Mr. Chairman, what the example that I gave was the broader, when I'm talking about the misdemeanor, the broader definition of public servant incorporates us. And I gave the example of a staffer trying to impress his or her girlfriend utilizing your stationery and sending out a letter to somebody. Could even just be to one individual. And now suddenly you can be charged with a crime under the any act language.
Of course, it's been like that for, let's say, 20 years.
Yep.
And I'm unaware of anybody getting charged for that sort of minor of a offense. I have your same unease, but I guess I've come to an equilibrium on the issue by saying for a B misdemeanor, they're probably going to only charge the most egregious violations.
And just to wrap up, Mr. Chairman, what about just taking the same language that you inserted into the C felony and replicating it to the lesser offense there? And so that you're making it clear that the person has to be purporting to exercise authority.
Of the public servant.
Yeah.
In relation to another person.
Any act.
That seems reasonable to me. Is there an argument against that from the sponsor?
I think the sponsor cares about the C felony, not about the B misdemeanor, if I'm not mistaken.
I would tend to agree with Senator McGuire on that.
then...
Do a conceptual amendment?
We'll do a conceptual amendment to incorporate... Senator McGuire, do you want to state what your proposed amendment is?
Yeah, so the conceptual amendment is to make Section 2, the misdemeanor offense that applies to the broader public servant category, consistent with the peace officer felony language by narrowing on line 11 the any act language to purports to exercise the authority of a public servant in relation to another person.
Section 2 would read, a person commits the crime of impersonating a public servant in the second degree if the person pretends to be a public servant and purports to exercise the authority of a public servant in relation to another person.
Exactly.
That's the amendment. Is there objection to the amendment? Hearing and seeing none, the amendment number 1 is adopted. That brings the bill back before us for a committee discussion. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move CS for House Bill number 286 as amended today with individual recommendations and zero fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill's moved. That brings us to SJR 28. And HJR, I beg your pardon. Thank you for the question. Just going a little too fast this morning.
There are
a little too fast.
House Joint Resolution.
HJR 28. Brought to us by Representatives Samuel and Dugan. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Come on up, Mike. Slide this over there.
Thanks, Hollis. I just can't.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Please proceed.
Thank
Put
you,
yourselves
Chairman.
On the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the hearing. For the record, my name is Ralph Samuels, the representative from District 29 in South Anchorage. HJR 28 sets up an endowment-style fund out of the Constitutional Budget Reserve, and I can go into the reasons why, but generally speaking, that's what it does. It's got a 5% payout. That payout automatically goes without a separate vote of the legislature. It automatically flow into the general fund. It could then be spent on government services. It could be reappropriated back into the fund. It could be reappropriated into the permanent fund. Whatever the legislature that year chose to do with the 5%, the legislature would have the prerogative to do with it as they would. The bill started out as a mechanism, and it did not incorporate the CBR. And I had the bill drafted as a separate constitutionally created fund that for 5 years it would be constitutionally mandated that all of the money from the progressive feature of the petroleum tax would
ACEs.
What's that?
Of ACEs.
Of ACEs,
yep.
Right? Of the tax. Everything associated with the, where the tax went up according to the price well. So all of the progressivity money would get put into this separate fund aside from the CBR. And a couple of reasons. First of all, I think it is important that the public realize that endowments are not evil. They would get a chance to vote on this. Secondly, I think it would take a chance to actually save a bunch of money, not just have, as it was called by one House member, a deferred spending plan, where you would just, you know, you're going to access it later with a three-quarter vote when you needed it. And thirdly, it would have provided a separate cash flow mechanism into the state coffers that was not associated with the price of a commodity, whether it be oil, gas, gold, fish, or timber. I mean, our entire state budget, as you were well aware, almost solely depend on the price of oil from the public sector. So those were the ideas behind the concept. It got through the first committee in the House, that way through House Judiciary Committee. And in the next committee, a group of us, including the representative to my left here, kind of broadened the scope a bit, if you will. And instead, we applied the concept, instead of a new fund, we put the CBR into the fund. And the reason for doing that is, in order for an endowment to begin an effective cash flow mechanism, you have to put a whole lot of money at the front end. You know, in my 401k at Penn Air, and I max it out every year, and when you first started, you're so proud when you got $10,000 put in there, and every dollar that you put in really makes a difference. But after a while, after it gets built up to the point where you can actually spend money off of it, the money you put in is less relevant. But if I'd only put $50 a month in, the $50 becomes relevant. So what you want to do is at the front end, when you have money and you don't need the cash, I mean, a young guy at Penn Air, for instance, he doesn't have kids yet, he doesn't have a wife yet, he doesn't have a mortgage yet. I go around and I travel around the state as a trustee on that fund, and I go cram as much money into that as you can and let the interest work for you while you don't need the cash. and I convinced very few 21-year-old people.
It was ever thus, I think. It was ever thus.
However, some. So that's the thinking behind it, is while we've got money, you want to put as much money into this endowment so that it actually becomes a real-life cash flow. And the way the math works out is, after this year, let's say you have $6 or $7 billion in the CBR, depends how the politics works out. And
the amount in the CBR now is
three.
Yeah, three. A little bit over three.
And the supplemental put in three?
2.6.
You're right. And I think the capital bill put in $400 million.
Right. There's supposed to be another $1.4 billion in the two bills, right?
Correct. And then there's some in the supplemental budget reserve, which I'll get to in a second.
So, I mean, all things being equal, we think we're going to have a CBR at the end of this session of?
$6 or $7 billion.
$6 or $7 billion.
And if we have another year like this, just for the sake of math, if you can get to the point where you have $10 billion in the CBR at a 5% payout rate, you'd have a cash flow mechanism coming into the general fund at about $500 million a year. And in today's oil prices and in the atmosphere of this year, that seems like such a small amount. And I can guarantee, as you know, Senators, 3 years ago, $500 million would have been a whole lot of money. So the point is, if you can get that cash flow mechanism and save the $10 billion, get the cash flow mechanism coming into the general fund, that you'd have a different revenue stream. And philosophically, the way that I've looked at the bill is, the trade-off is that you take away the ability of government to take that money and spend it in order to balance the budget. And the CBR, once again, philosophically, and I don't know if Tam is online or some of the other folks in the room can correct me on the details, but philosophically, the CBR got created so that the price of oil goes up and down. You don't have these massive budget cuts in state government. You could kind of prop up the spending when you needed to. You know, Sheffield was here and he had to cut $500 million out of a relatively small budget in a year. And that doesn't help the economy. That money was going to go out into the private sector and get spent, and no longer happens. The economy gets deteriorated because there's less money circulating in it. The trade-off is government would no longer be able to access the $10 billion. So government would have to, if production drops off or if the price of oil drops off, you will force the people of Alaska and the legislature and whoever the governor is at the time, you will force the debate on spending caps, on revenue sources, and a very painful discussion that I know that at least the three of us have had before in my very short time in the legislature. You know, we've had the tire tax debate, we had a sales tax debate, we've had the POMB debate. We, out of the House 4 years ago, we passed a constitutional spending limit, which is very difficult to craft. So this debate, which I think is a healthy thing to happen, it happens sooner than it would have we just left the $10 billion open to government spending. And the reason to do that is, as the budget continues to increase, and it will, as the budget continues to increase, whether you want to argue it at 4%, as the governor said, or 11, or whatever the number is after it all falls out, as the budget continues to increase and the production continues to decrease, the longer you wait to have this debate on state fiscal planning and having some sort of a fiscal plan, the longer you wait, the more draconian the answers will be. The wider that gap gets, you won't have any place else to go. And if you have spent the $10 billion, the first year you need to get to the CBR, you'll go make a deal with whoever's in charge and whoever's in the minority. It matters not. You'll tap into it. You'll tap into it the next year. And there are some numbers that Mr. Teal will bring up here that will show you, and models are what they are. There's no perfect world. But you can see a pretty fast axe coming down where all $10 billion is spent. And after the $10 billion is gone, your problem is worse because you don't have a cushion. You don't have the $500 million cash flow. And in the meantime, your budget has still gone up further than when you started spending the $10 billion. And your production has continued to drop. So your gap gets wider and wider the longer you wait to have the discussion. And my belief, and I guess the soul of the bill, is I think the discussion is inevitable. And it is healthier for the community to have it sooner rather than later. And I can guarantee that Mike Dugan and Ralph Samuels would disagree on revenue sources and on budget caps, and we would have a fight, and we would fight like brothers and sisters. We do not agree on those answers, and we've never had the discussion, but I know, Mike, we're going to disagree on those answers, and that's okay. But if you are afraid to have the discussion, or you're not forced into having that discussion, you will not. The political arena is what it is. We don't have the discussions now at $110 a barrel. Well, we didn't have them very well until we were about to hit the wall at $20 a barrel. Decisions are better made when it's not a crisis situation. And we will bring the decision closer, and I think that's a healthy thing. The downside or the trade-off to the bill is what do you do, and Senator French, you and I have had the discussion as well as I've had it with Senator McGuire and almost all members of both bodies. What do you do if there's an earthquake? And what do you do if there is a shutdown of Prudhoe Bay that's not for the long term? The pipeline, something happens to the pipeline and you do not have revenues coming in for a short period of time. And there are a couple of answers to that. At one point in the House Finance Committee, we had a phase in. So we had the three-quarter vote money here, and we had the endowment money here, and 5 years later, they all phased together. So you'd have some sort of a cash flow mechanism in the short run. But when what we saw is when the Senate put money into the statutory budget reserve in the supplemental bill, and they put $1 billion away, that, to me, appeared to be a far better mechanism for short-term cash needs. And next year, the legislature could fight. Do you want to put more into the endowment? The two of us are going to be sitting here arguing, put more money in the endowment, put more money into the endowment. Other people were saying, I'm worried about the short-term, put more money into the statutory budget reserve. In the legislation, as it sits before you right now, the sweep provision goes away. So not only the legislature over the years has essentially, you know, with a wink and a nod, we sweep it and we reverse the sweep back. And we make a deal with whoever's in the minority at the time, and everybody says, okay, everybody gets a little bit of something that they want, but you reverse it and you reverse it, or you sweep it and you reverse it back. That wasn't the intent. The intent was to have the three-quarter vote to have access for emergencies only, and it has become a normal course of doing business. The sweep goes away in the legislation before you. Every year, every legislature would decide, what do you want to do? We got all the cash in front of us. The money from the lawsuits with oil companies, right now automatically goes to the CBR. That comes to the general fund. Everything would go immediately into the general fund. The legislature every year would have a fight. Do you want to put it in an endowment? Do you want to put it in the statutory budget reserve? Do you want to spend it? What do you want it? You can leave it in the general fund. What do you want to do with the money? And every legislature would then choose. One thing that you do get to do is you take current revenue so that the oil comes up out of the ground, we turn it into stocks and bonds. And this generation of legislatures, I got asked by one House member, Ralph, the needs in my community are too great. I don't want to lock up the money. And my answer to that is, if I take all the money and answer your needs, the next generation of Alaskans, the next generation of legislators that come along, do you think for a second that those needs disappear? So that 20 years from now, after you got to spend the money, the next guy sitting in your chair doesn't get to spend the money. Under the endowment method, everybody gets a little bit throughout time. Us, Grayson, his kids. If you move, you don't get any more. But nobody gets to spend all of this oil wealth, this non-renewable resource. Everybody gets a little piece of it. And I think the short-term cash, which is the biggest concern I've heard from a lot of people, can be alleviated by saving some money in a short-term cash need, a statutory budget reserve type fund, so that you've got some cash here, and next year you fight it out. You put another $1 billion in there, you put another $2 billion in there, you can save as much money as you want in that short term, tapped in by a majority. My problem with doing that is if it's available, we'll spend it and it won't be. It'll be an emergency as defined by the legislature. And the emergency will be, I don't want to talk about revenue sources and budget cuts. That's an emergency. So in general, that's kind of what the bill does, both practically and philosophically. Mr. Teal can walk through an interactive model that will point out some of the various scenarios with budget fund or the general fund growth, production decline. It's an interactive model that's pretty interesting to watch. I met with the Department of Revenue. They had two ideas for amendments. One, they There were concerned about a bond rating, about if you lock up a large amount of cash, about a bond rating issue. We have an amendment that we got from Tam Cook that we think would alleviate that concern. The other concern that the Department of Revenue had was that they go just to balance the budget, what I call a line of credit, and is they go in and out of the CBR. The general fund borrows from the CBR, the state borrows from it, and they just pay it back. And they kind of go in and out as a line of credit, and they don't want to lose the ability to do that. We're talking to Tam about they had an amendment. We talked to Tam about fitting into her language, and we're still working on that amendment. We don't want to end up with a $10 billion fund which is invested for short-term credit line needs, and we'll work with the department on that, and we'll get that to you. I'm assuming this bill's not going to move out today, so
probably not today.
Yeah,
even if I tried right now, I think I couldn't do it.
So I'll get that amendment to Cindy and Tam. We've been working with Tam and the department on making sure we alleviate these other problems. And with that, I don't know if Representative Dugan has some comments also.
Just a couple of things, thank you, Representative Samuels, if you might. Sort of two points. One is that what Representative Samuels said about $500 million a year is true. Right now, $500 million doesn't look like too much. But the last time I looked at the numbers for what the state would get if it reinstituted the personal income tax, at roughly the same terms that it had when we got rid of it in 1980, you were just slightly north of $300 million. So if you weigh it like that, a $500 million a year income stream off of the new constitutional budget reserve looks pretty good. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I just wanted to draw your attention to, I'm sure David will have some more to say about this when he gets up here, but really there are sort of three salient facts about the state's financial picture right now. One is the rate of oil production, the second is the value of a barrel of oil, and the third is the growth in the operating budget. And there's a bunch of numbers in this that you can play with, but I believe that it's correct that if you annualize the growth in the operating budget over the last 5 years, it's been roughly 10% a year. And if it's compounded, that's a 67% growth in the operating budget. So it's clear that continued large growth in the operating budget wipes out everything. I mean, it becomes pretty quickly the single biggest factor, and no matter how much oil you're producing or really how much it's worth, unless it goes to $200 a barrel or something,
it's a whole new set of problems.
Right, which creates a different set of problems, that you have to pay attention to that. And there's been discussion about this in some ways as a kind of spending limit. And insofar as it works that way, I'm in agreement with it. Because if what we do is continue a pattern that where we got a bunch of money, we spend a bunch of money, then we don't have a bunch of money anymore, you end up cutting the budget and doing that kind of thing, you get back into yo-yo budgeting. Some of you have been here long enough to remember what that felt like, and never looked very good to me looking at it from the outside. I don't expect it looked any better to you looking at it from the inside. So those are just sort of two things I would like you to think about a little bit as you think about this particular piece of legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on that point also is there was a sales tax debate that went on in 2002 and 2003, and for at that time with those numbers, and it can't be that much different now. For every 1% of sales tax on a statewide sales tax, and I don't remember the rate, but it was $100 million. So you'd be looking at a $500 million cash flow stream would be akin to a 5% statewide sales tax. And I can't remember exactly what the rate was, but
it was like
3%, if I remember correctly.
It was supposed to cap out at 3.
And they were capped at different, in different communities. And so mostly, though, it was $500 million would be a 5% sales tax, and that would be a cash flow mechanism coming off the CBR.
Thank you, gentlemen. I can't resist the opportunity. I've got two highly intelligent individuals from the House of Representatives here who have thought about this idea, and it's really a fascinating philosophical question. And let me just pose what's probably a rhetorical question back to you, but the question is why do you suppose, when was the last time we put money into the permanent fund corpus? And I think it's been before I got here, which was in 2003. I don't think we've made any deposits to the corpus. It's been some long time. And the reason, I think the reason why we're not thinking about putting money in the corpus of the permanent fund right now is because we know we can't ever get to it. And I'm, Representative.
Sorry, if I might, Mr. Chairman, it's not just that we can't ever get to that. We can't ever get to the earnings either. Under this plan, you do get to the earnings. They come to you automatically. The difficulty with getting to any part of the permanent fund, and let's just talk for a minute about the earnings, assuming that, you know, we're smart people, we're going to leave that money invested as long as we can before we start spending that, is that you have to solve all of the problems, the political problems, yes, dealing with the permanent fund simultaneously, which means you have to do something about the dividend. I don't know if you put it in the Constitution or what you're going to do. And you have to be able to convince the voters of the state that the trade-off is worth it to them, right? Because this is really, this is sort of the thing that everybody focuses on. I remember pretty well the discussion about the cap of the permanent fund dividend that was proposed. I forget when that was, 4 or 5 years ago, maybe.
Yeah.
$1,111.
Right. That didn't go very well because, frankly, the groundwork hadn't been done. So if you were going to talk about doing that, you're talking about a process that's probably going to last a couple of years and maybe longer, just sort of trying to work out the terms of what it is you want to present and then presenting it and doing it often enough that people whose job isn't to pay attention to these things understand what you're trying to do. And I don't know about Representative Samuels, but when we started talking about this, one of the first things I said is, frankly, I just don't want to get involved in that right now if we don't have to, because it's going to take a long time and a lot of effort to do that. If you have to do it, you do it. If you don't, you kind of put it off and maybe try something like this and let people see how it works.
I got one comment on the permanent fund, kind of the flip side of the rhetorical question, and it's a valid point. However, I believe the number is about half of the money that's in the permanent fund now was actually made by deposits that weren't constitutionally mandated, a third to half.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I don't know if it's a little more than half, a little less than half, but all of that money was put in there by the legislature so that we wouldn't spend it. And if we had not done that, we would have a $20 billion permanent fund. We would have exactly the same problem we have now, if not worse, because a lot of that money would have gone into the operating budget. We would have had worse problems, and you would only have a $20 billion permanent fund. You'd have spent the money. The Alaskan community would have spent the money. You would have a smaller permanent fund right now, and you would have less resources to draw on as you go forward with the what I consider the inevitable debate you will have on fiscal planning for Alaska as oil production continues to decline. You would have less of a resource to draw on in the future. Right now, I believe that the earnings of the permanent fund are going to play a role. I believe that cutting budgets are going to play a role, and I believe that some broad-based tax is going to play some form of a role in the long term. In the 20-year term for Alaska, all of these things are going to play into the debate somehow. And now that we do have a $40 billion permanent fund instead of a $20 billion permanent fund, the decisions are easier, and the road will be a whole lot less rocky.
Senator McGuire's question, just let me make an observation, and the observation is, why isn't this year's legislature a good example, a good counterargument to your position, which is we're not spending all the money. Frankly, we're saving huge amounts of money. We're spending a lot, but we're saving a lot. And the fact is because, you know, for a variety of reasons, we can't come to agreement on how to spend the money. but isn't that at some level a check on, a legislature run wild? It's more of a comment than a question, but if you want to respond, please do.
I would like to respond. When I started, and I've only been in the legislature for, this is my sixth year, so I've been here for 5 years, we spent $2.5 billion of general fund dollars. This year it's clear the smoke away, and it's between 4.1 and 4.4, somewhere in there. So, and at the same time, a lot of that money has been, as the federal largesse has dropped, we keep backfilling the federal government's role. The federal largesse is going to continue to drop. So we have saved, and I think we've done a good job of saving money this year, but we've also, in my 6 years here, we're darn close to doubling the general fund budget. And they're all good projects, and it's tough to say no, and there's good capital projects and all of these things, and generally I agree with it. But then I look back to 5 years ago, and I go, what happened? What happened to the budget where we're spending almost double? So we do a good job of saving because we have so much money. But when the model comes up, you will see some interesting numbers on what could continue.
Senator McGuire.
Yeah, just a couple of points.
Oh, let the record reflect that Senator Terrio, the camera showed it, but I'll reflect on the record as well. He joined us a few minutes ago.
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot, the point that you made, and the analogy that I made in my mind was that if I had two certificates of deposit that I was going to enter into with the same pool of money, let's say 40 grand for easy, and why would I take the principal of that and put it into two separate certificates of a deposit when in fact it would be better to combine the two $20,000 amounts and have a 5% payout on the $40,000 principal? And so I think of the permanent fund and I think of this concept, and the thought has crossed my mind that it would be more efficient, that we would have a better payout and a pooling of assets to do it. But what I think I discovered in the early, my first term, when we were, I think we got up to $14 a barrel, but we had every vote you could think of. We had sales tax, income tax, use of the earnings, all of it. And what I discovered in that debate was that there is this very genuinely held philosophical difference among Alaskans. And what it is that the money that we're talking about here is perceived as government money, and by some, and the money that's in the dividend is perceived as individual money, citizen money, by some. And there are others who believe that there isn't a whole lot of difference between the two, and that the money that we generate off of our oil wealth is invested into roads and schools, and that benefits all of us. So there isn't a whole lot of difference. But there are people who genuinely hold the belief that they are separate concepts, individual citizen wealth versus governmental money to be used for governmental purposes. And because of that, I don't think you ever get around the political, practical, philosophical problem of trying to combine those two savings accounts. And then the other point I want to make about the advantage of doing something like this versus relying on a legislature to put aside money is that, yes, we have a lot, and so we have saved a lot because of that. But I have seen, in my eighth year now, I have seen times where that has not been done. And so what you do is you take the guesswork out of whether or not you're going to have a legislature that will put it together in a, fiscally prudent way, and not spend too much. You just take out the guesswork, and you say it's 5%. And then the final thing there is that you get the advantage of having an endowment, and I think we all know the benefits of having an endowment.
Gentlemen, want to respond, or let me ask you maybe a more provocative question? You can respond to: why not do this by statute? Why not create a statutory budget reserve that has a whole heap of money in it, throws off $500 million a year as long as we need it, and then when we don't need it, or when we need it more, so to speak, we can start reaching in a little bit and sort of slowly amortize that corpus down and create a soft landing in that manner.
Science and tech. Three words.
Yes, the science technology found. Yeah. Wait. I voted against that, but go.
But what I believe that the legislature process would do, and
who could swallow that? It'd be a pig in a python, for crying out loud. How could you swallow $10 billion in one spell swoop? Please go ahead.
To be perfectly honest, even the when the Department of Revenue came forward with the saying we want to make sure that we have the debt. We want to make sure that the bond rating isn't hurt, and we've got an amendment here. And in my mind, after they left my office, I thought, okay, I'm in the legislature in the future. The money's run out. I want to avoid the tough debate. I don't want to have the debate on taxes. I don't want to cut the budget. I don't want to make these tough decisions. I want to avoid it. What would I do? I would dump as much as I could onto bonds, and I'd go after the free money in the $10 billion. That's what I would try to do, and we've tried to limit it, and we had the discussion. I'm not speaking out of school with the department here. I think that if you put it in the statute, it will still be easier, no matter how difficult it is, to go after the corpus than it would be to have the debate, and you would end up in exactly the same place. It would be easier. The three-quarter vote was meant to make it difficult, and it was just the way we do business. It was easier to go get the three-quarter vote and get the money out of the CBR than it is to start the debate on actual revenues and saying no to budget items. It was easier to do that with this, because in the statutes, I know that the governor had a plan to have an endowment, and I can't remember how big it was, but have an endowment for transportation projects, I believe.
$1 billion.
What's that?
$1 billion.
$1 billion, and it would spin off. And I believe that when push came to shove, instead of having a difficult debate, the legislature would go in and they'd spend that $1 billion. It would be easier, and you'd say, boy, because would be fill in the blank, because this road project is going to be generational in nature, and then the money would be gone, and you would once again, back to the philosophy of it, you'd be in worse shape after the money's gone, because time has passed and your budget has continued to go up. So statutory isn't quite going to cut it. I think the legislative body, with no bad motives on anybody's part, will avoid everything heads to the middle and everything goes to the easier path. And if there's no money there, you cannot go after the $10 billion. You get your generations, you get your 5%, then it is going to last for the long term over the history of the state.
Representative Dugan.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, thank you. One of the things that's difficult to figure out here is this idea of a Democratic government having savings. The way the model is set up to work is you go in, you're the legislature, you decide sort of how much money you want to spend, and then you set your tax rates. It's a zero-sum game, and at the end of that year, you're back to zero again, and you start over again. If you're doing what we're doing, which is we're a resource owner in addition to being a sovereign, and so we've got other revenue that comes in, and it doesn't come in that evenly. We can't, since however it worked out, we can't control oil production. We really can't control oil revenue. Then you have surpluses. Sometimes you have deficits. Right now we've got surpluses, and then you have to start to think about what does it really mean to save that money in a realistic sense of that word. And what I would say is that there's a sort of a spectrum. You can call it deferred spending, or you can call it savings light, or you can call it whatever you want to, but that would be money that's one way or another laying around, in a fund that you can access in the way that we normally access money. As I've been thinking about it, I've come more and more to the conclusion that it's not really savings unless there's some sort of barrier between you and the money that has to be overcome. Mm-hmm. Right now what we've got is a three-quarters vote? Is it a three-quarters vote in the CBR? So that really seems like savings to me, although I'm told really that the legislature's always found a way to get around that when it wanted the money, and so, you can question whether it's long-term savings. But I think it's fair to say that the more difficult you make it to access that excess, that surplus revenue, the more saved it is, if that makes any sense to you. And that you want, in times of high revenue, to save it as best you can. Mm-hmm. Because it's only if you do that that you're going to have this kind of discussion that Representative Samuels has been talking about. If you don't do that, then it's just going to be there and everybody's going to look at everybody else and say, oh yeah, we'll use that money, and that'll be the end of the discussion. So my real point here is it's sort of an odd duck. I mean, us, a Democratic government, having excess revenue is sort of an odd set of circumstances, and it just requires a lot of thinking. I'm not really sure I've figured it out entirely myself yet.
Thank you, Representative. Let the record reflect that Senator Huggins has joined us. Senator McGuire has a question.
Thank you. And Representative Dugan has touched on a point that I've discussed with our Albertan counterparts many times, which is the fact that we are a resource-based economy. And so we have this highly volatile income stream that isn't set up in the traditional democratic way that he describes, wherein, you know, you take a percentage of personal income tax or consumption tax, sales tax, et cetera. And so I think that's what makes this kind of a bill, this kind of a constitutional provision so necessary, is that it's about eliminating the volatility as best you can. And then the other thing I just wanted to say on the statutory part, should you run into trouble, because it's interesting, the further this bill goes down the line, the closer people see it to passing, the more nerve-wracked there are some folks in the building that are. And I just want to give you a fallback position. Should you fail to get the support for it, try implementing it in the statutory budget reserve. Try an endowment approach and see if we can do it. I bet what you said. I bet we don't do it. I bet we say we're going to do it, and we create all kinds of reasons and excuses to put our hands on the money for the projects we want that year. But I would consider doing it. And, you know, the problem with statutory fixes as opposed to constitutional is they're so amendable. And I can just remember my first three-quarter vote. I thought it was the weirdest thing I had ever seen. I did not understand why we were making this sweep and back again, and schools were flying around and roads and the three-quarter vote. And, you know, it was a complete perversion of what the intent of locking up that money was for. It was to eliminate that volatility. It was to keep us from willy-nilly reaching into it, and we perverted the intent of that. And I think future legislatures will do the same. And quite frankly, what it comes down to is nobody wants it to happen on their watch. Everyone's up for election in the House every 2 years, so even more volatile over there. In the Senate, you know, half every 4 years, so every 2 years you've got 10. And nobody wants it to happen on their watch. They don't want to be the ones that make the tough choices.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Terrio had a question.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, to your statement as far as statutory budget reserve, that it doesn't, of course, bind a future legislature. Constitutions are things that limit the powers of branches of government. And so without it, just like the money that we parked in the statutory budget reserve now, it's just the general fund with a different name on it. It might have a different rate of interest being earned on it, but it just is the general fund. So if you were to create some kind of an endowment, similar to science and tech, perfect example, it was just general fund money with a different name, and it spent just like general fund money when the time came. That's exactly what happened. And there wasn't that, there was a small constituency advocating for its protection, but they finally just succumbed to the demand for dollars that year. With regard to Representative Dugan's comments on generally a democratic government is sort of a zero-sum game. You tax at the level to support the governmental services that you're doling back out. That's true. That's the way it generally works. And of course, because we're a resource-based state, it's a completely different mechanism. And in fact, I had heated debates with the previous senator over that. Why were we changing the oil tax to more than it took to operate our government for that year? And wouldn't that have an adverse effect on our economy? But yet my view was, the Constitution doesn't tell me to sell the resource for less than market value just because we don't need the money this year. If I had a piece of property, would I sell it for below market value just because my wife and I, we don't particularly need the revenue this year? We might in our retirement years, though, so maybe I'd bank some of that money for those leaner years, and that's what I view that we do. That general democracy would, of course, be taxing my sweat of my brow, you know, through an income tax. But when we're selling a commodity, that's a completely different mechanism. And so we do have this thing because of the high commodity price. We've got a surplus now. And looking at a creative mechanism to carry some of that forward, to force us to, you know, I'm intrigued. I understand some of the criticisms and concerns, but I think it's still, I'm thankful that you're having the hearing today so that we can look at it, play with the model a little bit, and see how it might work.
And I definitely want to get to that. I want to get to the folks who are signed up to testify And so maybe we should turn to that now. Gentlemen, thank you. Let's go ahead and do the public testimony, then we'll turn to turn to Mr. Teal and the model, and so we don't keep folks who are on the line too much longer than they have to. Let's go to the off-nets in Anchorage. Jason Bruni signed up to testify. Mr. Bruni, how are you?
I'm doing well, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Please put yourself on the record. We'd be happy to hear your testimony.
For the record, my name is Jason Bruni. I'm the Executive Director of the Resource Development Council, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to comment today. RDC is a statewide private economic development organization with the mission to grow Alaska's economy through responsible resource development. RDC's diverse membership encompasses all of Alaska's basic industries, oil and gas, tourism, fisheries, mining, and timber. Our membership also includes construction companies, labor organizations, all of the regional native corporations, local communities, and a wide variety of industry support firms. It is on behalf of this diverse membership that I give my testimony today in support of HJR 28. RDC's number one legislative priority for over a decade has been the development of a comprehensive, responsible, and long-range state fiscal plan. As you know, in order to encourage new businesses to invest in Alaska, we have to prove that we have our fiscal house in order. We are the only state in the union that does not pay either an income tax or a sales tax. And in addition, each Alaskan gets an annual check from the permanent fund dividend. This year it was $1,654. We are very fortunate. I can tell you for a fact that companies that do invest in Alaska are worried that if they are successful, given our recent track record, they will be the next ones on whom taxes will be increased in order to pay for state services. Regardless, HJR 28 provides an avenue to have a means to pay for these services without raising additional taxes on the industries that are the core to our economy. The increased revenue generated from the recent enormous tax increases on the oil industry should be saved for a rainy day and not being spent with no respect for or view of the future. As you know, oil throughput in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System was over 2.1 million barrels per day in the late 80s. Today, the pipeline transports nearly one-third of that amount of oil. But fortunately, oil prices have saved us. With an annual projected decrease of 6% or greater in throughput, we must make a concerted effort to save this excess revenue for the future. HJR 28 does this, and we commend the bill's author and co-sponsors for their efforts. That said, institutionalizing progressivity in the Constitution is not something RDC supports. We are on record as supporting the legislature reconsider the gigantic tax increases of the last several years, and I reiterate that request. But as this is unlikely, we support the state doing everything in its power to save some of this excess money and therefore support HJR 28. Coupled with the hopeful passage of HB 125, Representative Hawker's fiscal planning bill, this constitutional amendment will go a long way to helping the state achieve a responsible fiscal plan. RDC has long supported a percent of market value usage of the permanent fund, and as this has not yet happened, we definitely are supportive of creating this new endowment and the subsequent 5% annual usage for state services. In conclusion, RDC supports HDR 28 and encourages this committee to advance this to the next committee. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Bruni. Next up, we have a person signed up as Arliss, and I just know who that is. I don't see a last name, but I think Mr. Jaluski may be up on the line there.
Yes. Thank you. This is Arliss Sturgeluski, and no doubt they couldn't read my writing, but I do support the piece of legislation, HJR 28, and certainly would like to see that move forward. I think there's two issues when we talk about money. One is predictability, and the other is sustainability. On predictability, I think those of you in the legislature, you may have disagreed on some, have really done a tremendous job this session in speaking to that issue. Some $5 million in various accounts, CBR, statutory budget reserve. You've addressed, I think, very responsibly education funding. The PERS and TERS, I know it was a difficult decision, but you've addressed that through the pension obligation bonds. But I also think that you've let schools and local government know what your role will be toward further increases for them, and that predictability is really important. I like the fact that you've addressed revenue sharing, that you set aside funding for, I believe it's for 3 years, and coming out of local government many, many years ago, that just is incredibly important, certainly to the small as well as the larger communities. So that's a lot on predictability, and you should congratulate yourself. But I think the issue of sustainability still has some work to be done. I think it was good the fact that you passed the bill calling for the 10-year kind of financial outlook. But one of the big things, of course, that's missing is the percent of market value on the permanent fund. I mean, here sits this huge fund variously in the last few months between $37 and $40 billion. And, you know, we each have our individual reasons for how we see that fund being utilized, but we're nowhere near a kind of a consensus on it, and yet it's going to play such a major role. So I think that issue of the permanent fund stands out there as a very large one, but you're to be congratulated. One additional thing, by passing the legislation that you have before you and going to the voters, is going to allow that fund to be invested more with market conditions. I realize you've taken out a portion of it that can be invested a bit for the longer term, but it's not certainly being invested as well as, say, the permanent fund in terms of amount of return and over the longer time. So I congratulate you for what you've done. I hope you'll pass this legislation and realize you have worked toward that issue that we've all been yammering for, which is a fiscal plan. There's still some parts, but you've gone a long way, and thank you for letting me testify.
It's nice to hear from you, Arla Sturgiluski. Any questions? I don't see any. Thanks again for taking the time to talk to us.
Yeah, anytime you can get Ralph Samuels and Mike Dugan to agree, you probably got a winner, huh?
They're actually sitting right next to each other, even as we speak.
Oh, my.
The last person from the public wanted to testify was Wayne Stevens, who's also here in the back of the room. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Stevens. Come on forward, put yourself on the record, and let us know what you think.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Wayne Stevens, President and CEO of the Alaska State Chamber. In the interest of time, I won't reiterate the comments already covered by previous testimony, but suffice it to say that the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce has long advocated and urged the legislature to adopt comprehensive fiscal policy. State Chamber recognizes that the first problem in adopting a comprehensive fiscal policy is to have a common definition of what is a fiscal policy. While the Chamber recognizes that no policy can bind future legislatures, policy should reflect long-term sustainability. This resolution is an excellent start in that process, and we would urge your adoption and forwarding on to the next committee of referral.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens. Questions? I don't see any. Thanks so much. Let's turn now to the finance wizards, or the finance wizard that we have here with us. Mr. Teal, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm David Teal, Legislative Finance. And I think you've all seen this model in one place or another.
Actually, I want to confess that I haven't. So you can walk me through it as if I were a neophyte.
Okay. Well, it's actually a fairly simple model. Here we have several oil price scenarios that you can select from, and what's selected right now is the spring forecast. And it just takes that and goes out to the revenue model that was developed back for the November session and say, at this price, and, you know, I'm not going to go through this model. As you can see, it's out on CH column, so you don't want to walk through them. But
you can shorten it for us. That's fine.
It takes each price and tells you how much revenue is generated, and as you can see, the surcharge revenue kicks in somewhere near $60 and increases rather rapidly beyond that. And you can also see that here, this is the revenue increase per dollar change in price. So we used to talk about, you know, $100 plus back in, this is under the gross tax. And as oil production fell, we fell from producing $120 million for each dollar change in price down to last year, it was approaching $60.
$60 million per dollar
of oil.
That's the last number I kind of had a grip on under right. the under the gross.
And with the tax change, that's closer to $100 million per each dollar change until the progressivity surcharge kicks in. And it continues to climb up. And as you can see, where we are now at, you know, the $100 price, you're talking each dollar change in the price of oil generating approximately $200 million in additional revenue.
Wow.
So that what you have is a substantial gain, and of course you get money from royalties and from the base tax as well. But the surcharge is large at current prices, and of course that's what's being deposited into the CBR to start this endowment on top of the current balance, which, as you've already discussed, is somewhere on the order of $6 to $7 to $8 billion, depending on how much is spent in this budget cycle. The fixed deposits were 3.6 plus the 400 plus the billion, but anything that isn't spent will be swept into the CBR. So the number that they're using is sort of, you know, well, plus or minus a couple billion, and that's true.
And that'll all get settled on the 31st of June, 30th of June.
Yes, whatever money in 08 isn't spent, and similarly in 09, unless the money is spent somewhere else, it will go to the CBR. So, again, back to the input, it also has production. You can select the production decline. I don't think that that's a driver in this model, primarily because it uses the actual spring forecast of production until after 2020, and then you get the decline that you specify here. But as you can see, there's been a lot of talk about a 6% annual rate of decline, but out here 10 years, we're still at 90% of current production. So in 10 years, a 10% decline is a long ways from a 6% annual rate of decline. But again, so I discount that because I think that anything that's going to happen, the interesting part of the model is the early years, not the later years, because you either have enough money to make it go or it's failed by that time. So what this model does is take revenue, and that's just price and production, and figures out how much your total revenue was, how much of that was due to a surcharge, and then adjusts it downward by production. And then it adds your non-oil revenue, which I just fixed at approximately the current values. So that's the revenue.
And remind me again what the non-oil revenue is. This is an addition made to the CBR every year.
No, non-oil revenue is
oh,
is
I see. Yes. Okay.
The
okay.
You know, the oil revenue is property tax, corporate oil income tax, or corporate petroleum income tax.
Non-oil revenue is everything else.
Yeah, and this is everything except the oil. So when we look at the CBR, as discussed, the current balance here is about $3 billion. And, you know, right now it's got some the older numbers in there. But basically, we could have a balance here of $6 to $7 billion at the end of 08. Now, what happens, as the sponsor said, is that it takes the oil surcharge and contributes that. So at any price of oil, takes the surcharge, subtracts it from your revenue stream, and puts it in the CBR instead. And then it also says, but there's a payout, and it adds that to your revenue stream. The payout starts fairly small because it goes back and takes a five-year average, and the average 5 years ago was $2 billion or so. But it quickly rises as the five-year average brings in these larger numbers. And so your payout should be somewhere on the order of the $500 million per year that they were talking about.
Starting in which year?
In, this is, oh, about 2013, 14, 15. In here, it hits $500 million per year and continues to rise after that, assuming that the CBR continues to grow because there's a surcharge, which, of course, depends on your oil revenue forecast. So you then can look at your surplus deficit calculations, and that's simply taking your available revenue plus your payout, giving you a total revenue, and then looking at your expenditures. And here's a key variable. These expenditures are growing at 4% annually. That growth rate is the big argument, along with what oil is going to do. That determines whether the model or the proposal works or doesn't work.
If you put GF at 10%, growing 10% a year, what happens?
I'll show you that in just a second.
Okay.
After I finish this, because here, what it says is we have a surplus, and now what you'll notice is that the surplus in these early years is due to high oil prices, and so we end up with not simply a CBR balance that approaches $20 billion here, but reserves held outside the CBR in the general fund or wherever you want
to. Statutory account,
yeah.
Some new creation, energy fund, whatever you want to call it.
That's also substantial, approaching $20 million here by 2020. And again, that's based on the spring oil forecast. So now you ask what happens when we change things. Well, first, you might want to look at where we are now. And this is reserves, and it is the 4% annual growth. And this just shows you how much your CBR balance is. And you can see that under the fall forecast, these colors don't show it at all here, but this in mine is a yellow bar, and it shows that under the fall oil forecast, the CBR built up a little bit, and you soon overspent. But that was with oil at $45. And we know we need oil at $60 or more to support the current level of budget, so it should be no surprise that you're looking at some very large deficits. You can see the same thing here. This is current oil forecast, and you can see the 4% growth rate is the line, the bars are the revenue, including the payout. So now, well, let's remember where you are. This is going to be no change in the oil forecast, but if we were to change revenue expenditure growth from 4% to 10%, you see right now that there's a surplus all the way out until here, the mid-2020s, given the base assumptions, 4% growth in the spring forecast. But if you change that to a 10% growth, that's same revenue forecast. You hit deficits by 2013, and you're completely out of control in this neighborhood. You unsustainable budget.
How long before everybody in the state works for state government?
Yeah.
Well, I guess you'd say but you can't do this.
I mean,
the model says this is what it's going to look like. It can't look like this. Because you simply
Right.
Can't spend money you don't have.
Thank goodness.
And, you know, we did talk about the sponsor and Representative Dugan. I guess you're both sponsors, right?
There's 20 of us.
20 of us. Not us, you. But the growth rate is a big argument. Is it 4%? Because that's what the governor hopes to hold it to. And that's one reason I used it. The other was that if you look at this is percent of GF surplus after operating spent on capital. You might want to look at the operating budget instead, comparing the GF surplus to the operating budget growth. And here you'll see that, again, the colors don't show, but there's a blue bar here that's the operating budget growth. And this was the surplus in that year. In recent years, you can see that growth has sometimes exceeded 20% in recent years, and this year is down around 15%. But part of that, and I don't think it's any coincidence, is that the surplus is also large. And you can see that for a number of years here, we had virtually no growth in the operating budget. And that's because, again, not coincidentally, there wasn't any money. You had deficits in many cases or no surplus revenue, and you didn't have growth. The last time we had big growth.
So just if I can interrupt you for a second, I mean, obviously one of the points that Representative Samuels or Representative Dugan make right now is surpluses spur government growth.
Yes.
Right.
And unsustainable.
You just can't. Right. The upward pressure is just too great for all of us to withstand. If there's no money, we can resist upward growth because we don't have the ability to print money. But with the surplus floating around the building, there's just too many yeses compared to the noes. As far as, you know, each individual project comes forward, it all makes sense. We like it. We spend money on it. Is this truism?
That's history. I mean, you can see that in the chart. When you have money, the budget grows. When you don't have money, the budget doesn't grow. Now, you know, will you continue to grow at 20%? I guess I doubt it, because you look at what's the cause of those recent 20% growth rates, and the growth is much less than the numbers would indicate, unless you think, well, where did we spend the money? We put $450 million into retirement in recent years. That's annually. Well, that was a big chunk of money, but we're now stabilized. So you had to accept it as
next year. Next year won't be a delta.
Now on it isn't.
You can spend $450 million each of the next 10 years on retiring PERS TERS liability, but it doesn't represent growth because it's the same $450.
The same with the $200 million or so in the tax credits under the new production tax. Were you handing about $200 million in tax credits back? So
I like this argument because it's going to help me defend what we did when I get back to the district.
Okay. So that and the 20% that you see isn't something that I expect to continue. But then again, you look at back at the history and you see, but it does. When you have a surplus, the operating budget grows. And as Senator McGuire just said, yeah, unsustainably. And it's because once it's in the operating budget, it's very difficult to get it out.
Senator Terry, you had a question or an observation?
Well, and on that point, even though, and it's a positive thing, we have set substantial amounts of money and will at the end of the year when the final sweep is done into savings.
Yes.
You look at that picture and you can't mask unsustainable growth in governmental spending. So the savings are a good thing, but not necessarily if they mask the unsustainable growth that's going along with that surplus.
Through the chair, Senator, and what I did in computing the growth there was subtract savings from spending. Right now, for instance, you see an operating budget, an 09 operating budget of $5.2 billion. But we talk about a $4.2 billion operating budget, because a billion of that is savings. But if you look at the bill and you look at our operating system, you look at our reports, it will tell you you've got a $5.2 billion budget because we can't differentiate a savings appropriation from a spending appropriation. It's simply an appropriation, and that's what we count. So I manually went in and removed savings from the recent years before taking these numbers, and as you say, Senator Theriault, it doesn't matter what you save. What really matters is what you spend, because you will spend what you're saving at some point in the future unless oil prices stay where they are.
Well, or unless you create a permanent fund that you can't touch.
Right. Similarly, here's
Senator McGuire.
Well, and I know you're getting to capital right now, but I was thinking back to the debate on Garvey bonds that we had years ago, and similar arguments behind it, the idea that you're sort of borrowing from the future, but you're also overstimulating, overheating in an unsustainable way the economy, and in particular sectors, if it's road projects and so forth. And so I know you're going to get to that now, and it'll be interesting to hear what you have to say. But in the operating area, you sort of create these jobs and these expenditures that never really go away. So the growth of government just continues. In the capital side, you're building things that have to be maintained, and ultimately you can't sustain that. And you're creating stimulus in places that, you know, shoot up and ultimately can't be sustained either. But that was, you know, AGC's argument against Garvey bonds is, yeah, it sounds great, but, you know, you get all these people employed building these projects, and then what, you know?
Please proceed. Thank you.
And this is the same type of graph. It's percent of the surplus, and this is after operating budget spent on capital. And where you see zeros, it just means there was no surplus to spend. But you can see that the current level of spending, the surplus on capital projects, is high, a bit relative to these years, but historically, this year's capital spending is not out of line with past surpluses, where, you know, in the 80s, you're spending 50% of your budget, of your surplus, on capital budgets. The current, this is the Senate proposal, was 18% of the surplus being spent on capital. And, you know, there was more than that spent in 06 and 07, which were also big surplus years. But back to this, you can see that 10% growth is not sustainable. This line is simply says that where we used to be up here on the DOR forecast, and now with 10% growth, you've gone from being up to over $20 billion to now breaking the system in, you know, 2020 or so, and facing $100 million, billion-dollar deficits out, cumulative deficits out here. So
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
What kind of production decline are you anticipating in oil?
That's through the chair, Senator. That's 98% continuation. In other words, a 2% decline beyond 2020.
What about until 2020?
That's using the spring forecast from.
Okay.
So there's it shows a decline, but, you know, it's uneven. Some years it's actually up. I don't quite understand the numbers, but Brian's here and can, you know, obviously we are getting a reduction in the major fields, but this is assuming new fields are coming online. Hasn't happened yet. These are just projections. And, you know, the same with all of this. They're just projections. And, for instance, if you go to here and say, well, this is the reserves held outside the CBR, well, we still show a surplus. What do you do with a surplus? In theory, you just hang on to it. The sponsors might say, no, we don't hang on to that. We we don't let this thing build under, let's go back to the 4%, where the surpluses are large and continuing, and you build up a balance that approaches $20 billion held in your general fund. Well, the graphs on percent of surplus spent on capital and operating should tell you that if this is held in the general fund, it's probably going to be spent. So you can choose to put this into the endowment, but it doesn't automatically flow into the endowment the way the surcharge revenue does. So I would argue that at high oil prices, this system isn't going to work unless you contribute additional money to the endowment. Now, at medium to low oil prices, there may be nothing to contribute. And if you contribute no more than what's required, you still get this large balance, and you still get this payout of seven, eight, growing to $1 billion a year. But if you were to put some of this money in as well, your payout would grow. But that's a legislative choice. I can't do anything about it. That's the way the resolution's written. And of course, you could probably revise it and say we're putting more in if it's available. But right now, this money is sitting there, and my guess is with money sitting there, you cannot hold growth to 4%. And you see what happens at 10%, which is the average for the past 25 years is about 6.5%. So, if you wanted to put that in, you get surpluses out until about 2020. But
it looks like a good year to retire.
Well, and then of course revenue is flattening and expenditures continue to grow.
Or Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Are you in these projections, are you including any additional revenue from a gas line?
No.
And it's anticipated that a gas line is going to come in 2020, right?
I don't know when first gas is coming, but certainly part of the reason for this is to get us to first gas.
I mean, from a policy standpoint, what I'm looking at is I'm anticipating a gas line in 15 to 20 years. I think most Alaskans are, hopefully earlier, but I think we need to prepare our fiscal house so that we can get through the next 15 or 20 years till the time when we have a gas line. And that's why I just wonder if this is really the best policy to take, if this really gets us through that time when we do have gas coming in and billions of dollars coming in. That, just comment.
More from you, Mr. Thiel, on the model. And I do have a question about production decline.
Oh, go ahead and ask now, because the model is there for you to do whatever you want to do with it. It's fairly easy to put in different choices here and choose a different forecast or different growth rates. And
right.
So I don't have more to say, so go ahead with your question.
Can you manipulate the production decline beginning this year and not wait until the end of the spring forecast? Do you understand my question? Can you make the production decline beginning in 2009?
Sure.
Okay. The production decline over the last, since 1989, has been 5% a year. And I hope it doesn't keep declining at 5% a year, but let's just take a look at what happens if it does.
Yeah. Different keyboard, can't find the...
Take your time, no pressure.
They're all just staring.
Okay, there's got to be a way to multiply on a keyboard that doesn't have a number pad, but I don't know what it is. Yeah. that would be your production.
So with a 5% decline rate, we go into deficit mode in 2012?
Yeah, let me make sure this is picking that up. It should.
Mr. Chairman, isn't that what you said in the Associated Press article a couple weeks back? You picked 2012, where it was, yeah, there was a statement in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
Was that based on having looked at the model, or?
I don't remember being quoted in an Associated Press article, but I'll double check.
Yeah.
Is that coming through?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And that's... Okay, sorry. The current run is the dark model, is the dark one here. So this is 4% expenditure growth,
mm-hmm,
with a production decline. You're not up in this neighborhood anymore, which is your $85 or DOR forecast. Instead, the model runs out of reserves, looks like in about 2020, and we should be able to go here and see the same thing, that your reserve balance runs out right in here.
Senator Wilikowski.
So let's say we do adopt this, the POMV approach to CBR, and then in say 4 years, price of oil goes down to $30-$40. We can't go into the CBR to take out the large surplus that we have. Where do we go? I mean, we don't shut down our schools and stop maintaining our roads and plowing our streets. So where do we go for the money at that point?
Through the chair, Senator, that's exactly what House Finance was asking the sponsors, and I guess the answer, you want to...
Representative Samuels, please.
Slide back in here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Wilikowski missed the first part of the debate, but what the bill, one of the intentional things it does is it brings the debate closer to us on... where would you get the money? You'd get the money, you'd either cut the budget or you'd raise money from somewhere else. It's exactly what you would do.
Or someone tries to take it out of the permanent fund.
Permanent fund earnings, you would have a permanent fund earnings debate. You would have people that would like an income tax. You would have people that want a sales tax. You would have people that want a big cut to the budget. You'd have people that want small cuts to the budget. Those are the five. You either raise more money or you cut the budget.
Well, there's one more, and in deference to your idea, people might say, "Ooh, let's turn the permanent fund into an endowment."
People could say, "Turn the permanent fund into an endowment,"
right?
Which I have voted for that a couple of times already.
Yeah.
And I guess,
Senator Wilkowski,
from my perspective, before I see a tax increase or taking money out of the permanent fund, I'd rather see us spend the billions of dollars that we have in our savings account.
I won't go through my entire spiel again.
But I apologize for not being here for
this. He can watch the tape later on this afternoon.
Actually, I apologize. You're the only one in the committee that I haven't had a chance to piecemeal into meetings. But generally speaking, the problem with doing that is, as I think Representative Dugan and I both feel, as you will just spend the money to kind of prop things up, the budget will continue to increase at some rate because it is very difficult to keep it down, and the production will continue to decline, and inevitably you will have the debate. Inevitably the people of Alaska are going to have this debate, but when you have to have the debate in a crisis situation, your problem will be bigger because the discrepancy between your bigger budget and your less production, the problem is bigger than if you draw it back and you say, let's have the debate now. I have diversified a cash flow stream from another source, from the CBR endowment, and you have the debate on a more reasoned approach rather than waiting till, I mean, every time that this gets wider, it's a more draconian event because you could end up very, very easily in a day, you can't get enough revenue or cut the budget enough without having a real shock to the economy, a mid-80s type, you know, the price of oil dropped and we're huge budget cuts which, you know, as a business guy, you'd think Ralph would agree with that. But a shock to the economy, the state spending money and circling around the economy of the state of Alaska is just as important as the dividend or taking tax out of somebody's pocket. However that money circulates around, if you take a bunch of money out of the economy at once, whether it be budget cuts, taxes, earnings of the permanent fund, you're going to have a shock to the economy. And I think the economy takes a bigger hit the longer you wait and the bigger this discrepancy is between what your future budget will be and your future production will be. So the sooner you have the debate on a measured approach and a reasoned debate, and if everybody just does it my way, that would be what I would consider a reasoned debate. But
and I'll just say two things. I mean, if oil goes down to $30, $40, there's going to be a shock to the economy.
You're underwater no matter what. I agree.
But I guess secondly, if we don't pass this, we can still do this. I mean, there's nothing to prevent us, the legislature, from doing this. The legislature could say, you know what, we're not going to spend the CBR, and we're going to just on our own appropriate 5% a year from that.
It's all on
we
the tape.
We could do that.
It's all on the tape.
I'll come by and visit.
Mr. Chairman, on this exact topic and point, in the second half of what Representative Samuels is saying is that it's the generational shift of responsibility and liability that I don't like as well. So it's not only that you are going to place that inevitable decision at a point in time that is so crisis oriented that now you're not trying to make up, you know, $500 million, you're trying to make up a whole lot more, but it's also the idea that you are encumbering one particular generation, one particular group at that moment in time with that liability, as opposed to spreading out and cushioning the years ahead. And I think that's the second half of it for me.
So, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might just comment on one part of what Senator Wilikowski said. There's a lot of people in the building who are working real hard to see that there's a gas pipeline. But you know what? No matter how good a job we do there and how soon that gas pipeline gets built, it's not going to pay like Prudhoe Bay. And so the idea that once we get the gas pipeline built and gas starts running down the pipe and we start getting those revenues, we're going to be okay, that's not actually going to work like that. It's particularly not going to work like that if we continue to increase the operating budget even at 4%. Because at some point, the increases in the operating budget wipe out everything. And if you, one of the salient points in the presentation that Mr. Teal made was one we just sort of went right over like we all knew it, which is, you know, non-oil revenue, $700 million. So you take that $700 million and you add what gas revenue you're going to get, you can't afford today's budget, let alone a budget that's based on today's that's been run up another 4%, or even if it's flat. You still can't afford this budget when you've got gas going down the pipeline. So it's not really, I mean, at least when I look at the numbers, I don't see the challenge as sort of bridging this to the gas pipeline, because the gas pipeline doesn't get us where we want to go. You know, it's really a matter of trying to figure out what we can do with the remains of what was a huge resource, an incredibly valuable resource, what we can do with that to make sure that there's some benefit for people who, I mean, on the policy level, for people who aren't in this room right now, and, you know, outside this building, for the people who are in the fourth grade now. And that's why I think that this is an important discussion, and I'm supporting this approach to that, because we can have the best hopes in the world for the gas pipeline, but frankly, the odds that, you know, gas is going to be worth as much as oil are pretty low. And so I think we have to be realistic in our ideas about what it is we're going to be able to do, even once that gas pipeline's running, if we can get the darn thing built. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Quite welcome. Let's turn now to the Department of Revenues. Sat here quite patiently for some time, and I know they've got a perspective on this. And so I'd like to hear from them. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman,
members. For the record, my name is Brian Andrews, Deputy Commissioner in the Department of Revenue. In hearing the sponsor's comments on the 401k plan concept that he was talking about with his employees, It reminded me of an example, and the example is that you can take person A at 20 years of age, and let's say they put $3,000 into an IRA account for 15 years or until they're 35, stop, and then you have person B that starts at 35 and goes for 30 years until 65. Portfolio A, or the earnings from portfolio A or person A, will always be superior to person B, even though there was twice as long contribution period. And the reason for that is that person A's portfolio was front-loaded, had a bigger balance, but more importantly, compounded earnings. In fact, Albert Einstein once said the most powerful force in the universe is compounded earnings.
We can just stop right now and say in the back of the room is the perfect example, and that's Mr. Motoro, who is about that age, and I hope he's listening carefully.
We'll call him up and see what he's doing in his investments.
But Senator Terrio has a question.
Mr. Chairman, it's interesting. When I started here as a staffer, those first 3 years, I put $2,000 aside, you know, an IRA for whatever it is. It is staggering what that has grown into. And it was just those 3 years before I got married, and, you know, it's amazing what it's grown into. So he should do it, and he should do it this year.
We'll pass a resolution out of the committee right now.
And I'll just say my wife and I put our daughter's PFD in the stock market last year. And
maybe try a certificate of deposit.
Mr. Andrews.
But the Department of Revenue does have two concerns with HJR 28. The first concern is locking up the corpus of what HJR 28 is trying to do to access of payment of debt service for the state's bonds. Right now, the annual debt service on the state's general obligation bonds, the certificates of participation, and the state-sponsored leases is about $70 million a year. Obviously, that can be handled well in the budget, but if there's some event in the future that we couldn't get to those monies, certainly the rating agencies would take a very dim view of locking up those dollars. So we just got a rating increase, and I would like to continue to maintain that, if not go for even higher ratings. So that's a big concern to us. The second concern is the liquidity factor that the CBRF provides to the general fund. And I believe in your packet, I provided a chart for you as to the cash flow requirements. And you will see that since FY94, various cash flow requirements that we've used the CBRF for. Now, in the past 3 years, 06, 07, and 08, we have not had any need to draw on the CBRF. But you can see in the past, we have. Now, from an earnings loss standpoint, when you structure an endowment, especially if one has about a 5% payout to it, you're going to keep a 5 to 10% allocation to cash equivalents, very short-term investments. And all I'm suggesting here is rather than borrow that or lend that money to the U.S. Treasury, you know, we should have the capability of the endowment lending that money to the state treasury to help it out with its cash flow needs. It's not going to impact the overall earnings of the endowment, as was suggested earlier. And you can see that on $6 billion, a 5% allocation to cash equivalents is going to be about $300 million. 10% would be $600 million, which, you know, for the majority of years would cover the cash impact or the cash needs that maybe the general fund would have. And, you know, with that, I'm open to questions.
Members of the committee, what do we earn in the CBR now? What's the CBR been earning the last few years?
There's two components to the CBR. The major component is there in a very liquid short-term investment profile, and we're looking at a 4 to 5% money market type of earnings. The sub-account within the CBR has invested both in domestic stocks and longer-term fixed income, domestic fixed income securities. And there the earnings, I believe last year, was close to 14, 15%.
14 to 15.
Yeah, in FY 7.
And that money, it's all captured inside the CVR. It doesn't migrate. It's there, and that's the way it always has been.
Correct.
Can I just ask?
Senator Willick,
I've never known the answer to. I hope you haven't covered this already. But, how do you decide what goes in this sub-account?
Well, the CBRF was there for liquidity needs. And you can see I've also provided in years past where the CBRF was used to balance the budget, or the budget overran and money was taken out of the CBR to balance the budget. So for the most part, the viewpoint to the CBRF is there. It's there for liquidity purpose and safety of principal. So we've kept it invested very short term.
Follow-up questions? Other questions? Senator McGuire.
Yeah, and in dollars, the amount roughly in the sub account versus the short-term 4 to 5.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, currently there's about $3 billion in the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. Of that, $500 million is in the $600 million is in the sub-account, and the remainder is in the liquid portion.
And what statute or law prevents us from pushing the 4 to 5% money into the 15% money?
Mr. Chairman, actually, it's at the call of the Commissioner of Revenue, and he can make that decision.
Very good. Further questions?
Mr. Chairman, just to further note, in the supplemental bill, there's intent language to put the majority of that contribution into the sub-account.
I see. So the new deposits we're making will be forced into the more active account. Follow-up questions? Let me ask maybe Mr. Teal this, and Mr. Andrews, but one of the things I've been trying to get a track of is where the pots of money are, because it seems over the last few years we've funded an education account, and we've funded money to build the pipeline a couple of years ago that never got spent. And so I'm just I've been wanting, maybe this would be something I could get after the committee, but just a sort of a one sheet description of, you know, how much is in the permanent fund, how much is in the earnings reserve, how much is in the CBR, how much is in the education fund, how much is in that capital account that I just referred to, as well as, you know, the other sort of pots of money that are being held right now by the state government.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be more than glad to provide that to you. I will tell you that when I was deputy commissioner in the 90s, the number of accounts were very few. When I came back last year, it has grown to quite an extensive list. So I'll be more than happy to provide that for you.
It just seems worth our while to take a survey of what's out there before we make a big move like this one. Further questions or comments for Mr. Andrews? It's now 3:20. We've been at it for a good couple of hours. With that, we're going to stand in adjournment.
Wilkin put out a...